Hi, Michaela Lafrac here. The podcast you are about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. Have you used a chatbot to answer a question or write an email? Or maybe you use Voice Assist in your car or get personalized recommendations on a music streaming platform. These are all forms of artificial intelligence, or AI, and they're becoming more common and more responsive by the minute. AI has also disrupted nearly every industry, including education. On Thursday, educators from around our region will gather in Burlington for a summit about AI in the classroom. That's also the focus of today's show. We'll learn how AI is currently being used by teachers, professors, and students, and dive into some of the ethical concerns. We're joined today by a teacher with nearly 40 years of experience working in schools. Now that he's semi-retired, Mark Nadanagara runs trainings for teachers on the use of AI. He lives in New Jersey, but he's traveled regularly to Vermont for his entire life. And he also makes up one-third of the team at AI Vermont, the organization putting on Thursday's event. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thrilled to be here, Michaela. Thank you.
Yeah, we're so glad to have you. We are also joined today by Juniper Lovato. She's a research assistant professor in the Department of Computer Science at the University of Vermont. Her research focuses on AI's influence on education and research. Juniper, welcome.
Thank you so much.
And speaking of UVM, our third guest today is Kirk Dombrowski. He's UVM's Vice President for Research, and he is co-leading the University of Vermont's AI Task Force. Kirk, welcome.
Great to be here. Thanks, Michaela.
All right. I'd love to hear from each of our guests as we kick off this conversation with some more examples of what we're talking about when we talk about AI and its use in the classroom. There's so many different ways in which AI is appearing in our lives today. It can feel a little overwhelming. Mark, let's start with you. Give us a couple examples.
Well, you made a really great point at the top of the show that we've been using AI for quite a while. People are familiar with it. They just don't realize that that's what they're using. You know, whenever you do a search, there's some AI involved. Siri talking to you is a bit of AI. And in fact, the history of AI, and this is an important point to make with teachers and students, goes back about 75 years. And we're going to celebrate the Turing test anniversary next year. So knowing that it just didn't come from out of nowhere is very important. But what did seem to hit us by surprise, of course, was generative AI in the form of ChatGPT. So some of the uses of that now, I think initially people were thinking of it as a sort of a souped-up search engine. Mm. But it's so much more than that. You know, when you do a Google search, it'll send you to some sites that you can click on and find the information yourself. Here, generative AI is pooling a much wider and broader field of information and coming up with an answer that a friend might give you in a paragraph or that you might ask a researcher to come across with. So in addition to that, because it's generative, it can generate more than just text. It can generate images. Now they're doing videos. So there are folks in the creative arts who are really tapping into this as a either a launcher or something to incorporate. I just listened to a public radio article about a musician who incorporated AI voices into her music, and it sounded pretty spectacular.
Wow, fascinating. And that means that AI is being used not just in, say, a computer science class, but in art classes, music classes, all
across
the board.
That's a great point, yes, everywhere.
Juniper, what about you? What are some examples of the ways that you're seeing AI be used in classrooms today?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think teachers have really started to integrate AI into their daily processes, both in teaching, but also in the administrative side. So teachers, as you know, have a lot on their plates. They're always trying to figure out ways to streamline their work. And AI is currently being used to help try to brainstorm ideas for lesson plans, for scheduling, and taking over some of these bureaucratic tasks, but also for things like personalizing education for their students. So these kinds of generative AI tools can be used to tailor content for more relevant contexts for certain students. This is often considered culturally situated learning, so being able to sort of streamline that or to change their lesson plans for students with different learning styles. This can also be used to make their lessons a little bit more accessible. So if you're thinking about students who have different learning styles or visual impairments, they can use AI to sort of very quickly change all of their lesson plans to accommodate students who may need lessons in different languages or in different formats.
Mm. Oh, so many different things to dive into here. Let's put a pin in some of those. And Kirk, tell us about some of your work, because you're working kind of at a high level at the University of Vermont, leading this AI task force and trying to figure out how AI fits in, not just in the classroom, but in all different areas of the university's work, right?
I think that's right. And I think, you know, Juniper and Mark both made great points. Mark, especially about the, you know, this has been around for a while. What we are calling AI, a lot of it is what we used to call machine learning only a couple of years ago. And that's been widely used in things like drug discovery and other kinds of data intensive work for a long time. And, you know, at least a couple of decades, and it's gotten much better. I think the changes we're seeing that are affecting the classroom and the large language models that Mark and Juniper were talking about are stunning. So we have a, you know, we have a situation where we have long time uses that make us feel like this is very familiar, and then brand new things that make us feel like it's a whole new world. My own work with the AI task force is I think I mentioned this before. I know Juniper has heard me say it before. You know, higher education is in the sentence making business. We ask our professors to make sentences in the form of lectures or research papers or oral presentations at conferences, and we ask our students to make sentences in order to get into the university and in order to pass their classes and eventually get out and get a degree. And so, when we now see large language models and generative AI that's capable of producing really good sentences, that strikes at the university's core business in a way we have not seen before. I think it's in that sense unprecedented. So some of the work we're trying to do is to figure that out. How does this new sentence making machinery influence how we go about doing our job in higher education?
Does that make you nervous or excited?
Both. I think I probably across the board in education from K through gray, this is both a very exciting opportunity and one that is very unsettling for all the reasons that we've talked about. This is really unprecedented in its ability to do things that we used to think only people could do.
Mm. Listeners, if you have been experimenting with ChatGPT or another chatbot, maybe have some questions or a funny story about it, give us a call at 800-639-2211. Or if you are a teacher or professor and have been figuring out ways to integrate AI into your classroom, we would love to hear from you as well. You can also email us this hour at vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. Mark, same question to you. Does this all make you nervous or excited for the future of education?
I'm with Kirk. It's a little of both. A good administrator, a good teacher tries to see both sides of any kind of resource or initiative. If you're bringing in a guest speaker, you want to know what they could possibly say that might disrupt the classroom, which could be a good thing. And you also want to know what they bring to the table that you couldn't otherwise do. And it's the same thing with AI. We need to really be careful about looking at the concerns because they're legitimate and listen to those people expressing them because they need to be heard. And we also need to share and experience and experiment with what the possible benefits are, which are many, as you've heard several of them here. One example right now that we're working with in New Jersey and possibly also in Vermont is there's a great teacher shortage after the pandemic. A lot of people left. People finally got to see what teaching was really like and are reconsidering going into that career. I teach first-year teachers, and that has acted like a filter. I feel that the students who are coming to me now really want to be teachers, which is great. But there's an opportunity for AI to help support these teachers. If they don't have good mentoring or they don't have a school system that has those kind of supports, to be able to go to an artificial intelligence that can answer their questions and help them generate ideas. We've even seen people, there are legal requirements here, but let's say you've tried all kinds of accommodations for students and they're not working. You plug them into generative AI and say, look, I've tried all these things. Is there anything else? And it's amazing what it can come up with. Mm. So in our work, we really try to bring all those folks in the room across the spectrum of, I never will and I'll do it right away and have them talk to each other and share what their experiences are and hopefully come to something productive out of it.
And that's what you're trying to create this week at this conference,
exactly
the
right.
summit at Hula, right? It's yes. one of a number of events that AI Vermont has been putting together.
Yeah, I think that's probably what you just said is the number one point of this. The underlying purpose is let's get everybody in the room. Let's first make sure we're speaking a common language. So we'll start off pretty simply with, you know, what is artificial intelligence? What is machine learning? Then we'll get into some of the case uses of it. And then we'll talk about maybe how, you know, we really should be talking about this because it also represents an opportunity for us to look at how we've been, as Kirk was alluding to, how we've been teaching for just about the past century. Maybe this is a disruption that will make us look at that and do better.
Mm. Interesting. Yeah, Juniper, I'd love for you to weigh in here because you really focus your research in part on AI's influence on education and some of those ethical concerns that can start cropping up. I know many parents and educators have those concerns right now as we see AI get used more and more by students and young people. Tell us a little bit more about your research, what you're focusing on.
Yeah, so I focus on the impacts of these emerging technology like AI on our social systems, so things like education, and what we can do to try to mitigate some of these harms and to be able to use this fun technology in a way that's sort of safe. And there's a lot of big ethical concerns here with AI, especially in education. There's a lot of bias in the data that's used to train these models. There's a lot of privacy issues, and there's a lot of environmental impact that I don't think we talk about enough. But specific to education, there's actually a lot of very unique challenges. So one is that in education, we're sort of in the business of trying to discover truths, and that's really important. And these tools, especially generative AI, doesn't always distinguish between what's a truth and a falsehood. And so this can be really problematic when we're using this as a tool in education. That sort of requires us to do a lot of fact checking and to make sure that what we're getting out of these tools is actually true. Another big issue with sort of using these tools in the education landscape is this idea of the epistemic gap. And so, so much of what we're doing in learning is sort of discovery through trial and error and experiencing and building out our knowledge in the classroom. And if AI can kind of do this for us, if it can sort of skip a lot of this generative process, then there's a lot of concern that these kind of fundamental cognitive processes will be bypassed, and then these students will sort of underdevelop these skills. And we're worried that we sort of might form this epistemic gap where the AI is sort of producing content that we're no longer able to understand. So that's sort of a big issue. And lastly, there's a potential sort of equity or access gap that might emerge. So if these tools really do become very fundamental in the education landscape, and if they're not free, then there may be sort of a haves and haves not issue where some schools have access to these great AI tools that help their teachers and help their students create sort of more personalized learning, and some schools sort of won't have access to that information.
Mm. Well, ahead of today's show, Juniper, I actually asked ChatGPT what it thinks is the biggest issue facing educators in Vermont when it comes to the use of AI in classrooms, and it gave me a list of five, but the first one was access to technology, this point that you just mentioned. I'll read the quote here from ChatGPT. It says, "Not all schools may have the necessary infrastructure or resources to implement AI technologies effectively. There could be disparities between urban and rural schools, as well as socioeconomic factors affecting access." Kirk, I'm wondering what your thoughts are there on this this access issue and how UVM might be addressing it.
I think it's a real issue. I mean, I think Juniper's spot on. And this has come down to us across every kind of educational innovation. We have an unusual way of funding education in the United States through property taxes, and that cements certain kinds of inequalities in place that we don't see in other kinds of educational funding models across the world. And so I think this will likely be no different in that way. I think part of the part of the way the challenge that this represents is the way that AI functions. So, you know, we can think about AI processing, machine learning kinds of things that can live at the edge of the network that provides us with all of this information. But that's usually very low level kinds of things. If you download a chatbot to your phone, you're generally working with a set of responses and a set of algorithms that can live on the limited capacity of your phone. Well, there are these mesotier kinds of functions that can live broadly in bigger computer environments. And of course, the real deep, heavy work of AI is done in large server farms. And I think Juniper was referring to that just briefly now about the environmental impacts of AI. And these are really intensive places. And so I think when we think about getting it into schools, the idea of getting some of the edge computing things into place won't be that difficult. They're a market-driven, they're a consumer-driven product, and so the price will come down. And even some of the meso things will be in the reach of most school systems, but really gaining access to the high-end cluster-driven AI large language models, especially, is going to be complicated and costly, and large school systems will have a distinct advantage there. I think the role of the university in that is, like many of the things that we do, we try to enable across the state. We try to provide what resources we can. The kinds of AI that we're talking about at these large clusters are much bigger than even we could run on our high-performance computing center at the university, which we have a large supercomputer clusters, a set of clusters at the university, and these models are even larger than that. So I think that the issue that Juniper raises probably goes all the way up even to the university level, where places like Florida or places, the giant universities out there, will have very differential access even than we could provide at UVM. Mm.
Well, at the secondary level, Mark, I'm curious if, you know, having worked in New Jersey schools for decades, have you seen these disparities between schools and the ways that they can access and teach with AI? Have you seen those already emerging?
You know, one of the, I'll say, interesting outcomes of COVID was a lot of federal money flooded into New Jersey schools, and most of them used it to boost up their technology so that students could learn from home. So I'd say, generally speaking, the schools are in decent enough shape to access this technology. That's another good thing about it. It doesn't really necessarily require high-end computing devices. But I'm glad that Kirk brought up school funding. We just heard in the news just before this segment that a lot of school budgets in Vermont were shut down. The same thing's happening in New Jersey. And most states have tried to balance out the wealth gaps. It turns out, unfortunately, that wealth is probably the number one predictor of student success, which it shouldn't be. But what we also have to address is what kind of technology do they have at home and what kind of support from parents do they have at home. Just read some research that said that it's the high-performing students who are most likely to use AI, and the students who are lower-performing are less likely. So as Juniper brought up, we're in danger of increasing that digital gap in yet another way.
Now, the head of Khan Academy, Saul Khan, gave a TED Talk last spring that went viral, and it was all about how AI is transforming education, in part by making AI into sort of a personalized tutor that each student can use. And he believes that these teaching platforms could dramatically close achievement gaps. Mark, have we seen any proof of that so far?
There's definitely no proof of that yet, and that actually, unfortunately, pertains to a lot of technology. There's a lot of hype and talk about it, but very little research. However, anecdotally, if any tool is used well, students can help achieve. I'd say Khan Academy is a great example of a disruptor before even AI came around, and that is the idea that we can be teaching ourselves. Of course, we normally say in education that works for those whom it works for, so there's some people that can learn very well by watching a video or following a tutorial, and others they can't. So in that sense, I think it does fulfill a role for students who maybe didn't understand what was going on in the classroom. They could go back in the evening and use AI as a tutor, as an assistant, as something to check their work. It's a great idea. So in that sense, for those who have access to it at home, it could close that gap.
Yeah. Jennifer, I'm curious for your thoughts on what Mark just said about how there's all these tools that are being used, but there's not always a lot of research really following their development and their impacts. Talk to us a bit about how some of the work that you're doing is trying to follow the impacts of these disruptive technologies.
Yeah, I think one kind of amazing thing that we've been seeing is as this new sort of generative AI models are being released, just how quickly companies are following. I think there's just a ton of new ed tech technology that's using AI, and that sort of ecosystem is just rapidly growing. I think it's going to be very difficult for folks to really figure out what is quality ed tech and what isn't. So I think there needs to be a lot more research in this area. I think the problem is that this is all developing just so quickly that it's very hard to sort of get a hold of exactly what's going on. Even as a researcher in this field, reading every single day, all the time, there's just so much development happening. So I think we are sort of in this space where it's really difficult just to keep up. Mm-hmm. But I think we do need more research. And I think this is one of the reasons why a lot of K-12 educators and also higher ed has been very cautious to sort of put down really strict policies around using these AI in education systems. I think we're all trying to figure out what is the best way to interact with these new tools. I don't think that we quite know yet. It's just happened so quickly and so rapidly that we're just kind of trying to get our bearings. But I think that there is just a lot of room for folks to start thinking really deliberately about how we're going to integrate these into our education systems.
Yeah. And Kirk, I imagine that's a really hard balance to strike in an institution like UVM, where you want to be cautious, you want to learn about all these new tools that are developing, but at the same time, you know, there are professors that are already using them to develop curriculum. There are students who are writing their essays using ChatGPT and, you know, getting away with that. Talk to us a little bit about some of those the ways in which I think you think that students and professors today are using AI at UVM that might need to be regulated or looked at more closely in the future.
Sure. There's been some great work by our Center for Teaching and Learning on this that have really tried to look at sort of how do you deal with this in a classroom setting, what kind of rules you can put on your syllabus and some of those things. I think an inordinate amount of the work that Juniper knows this well, that goes into education is about trust. And I think that one of the, where this raises questions of trust around some of those relationships, that's probably as big a danger as anything. I think we do best when we're at our best as educators and as an institution, when there's a good level of trust between students and faculty, and anything that disrupts that in the classroom is going to be problematic. And so policies are being developed, but as Juniper pointed out, it changes so fast. You can have a policy that sounds smart one day and really dumb the next. Some of the areas, though, that are sort of hidden behind some of this is, for example, we do a lot of work in sort of writing grants for writing applications for federal grants, and your phone is listening to grant reviews, and you can't put your grant proposal into a chatbot, one of the chatbots, or that's actually a disclosure. It's a public disclosure of the grant, and it vitiates any future patenting process that you might do, or you certainly can't put other people's grants into it. And so some of the work that we have to do, too, is talking to people about the proprietary side of this, which for our faculty and for research as a research institution is a really important factor that probably goes under the radar in most of the time.
Fascinating. Mark, when you work with teachers directly, do you get a lot of questions from them about ways in which their students are using AI that might undermine some of the trust that Kirk was just talking about?
That is, you know, how students are using it and their concerns about it is definitely the number one question.
Yeah.
I remember, you know, when ChatGPT came out, I actually waited a few months, started talking to educators and said, you know, to hear what was going on there. And I waited to hear what the advice would be from, you know, educational pundits and organizations and vendors. And it essentially was two things: buy our software to try to block it and increase the environment of academic integrity. Most teachers are already doing the latter. We're doing our best to build trust and relationships, and they understand how to do that. And that software just can't possibly keep up with the technology. So the third option I've been saying, and this is what I've been working with as teachers, is create situations where AI is either intentionally used. We're going to use it for this assignment. You're going to know how to use it. I'm going to show you how to do it safely, effectively, productively. Or we're going to use it as a piece of this process so that you're in charge of this and the AI is in charge of this. Or we're going to design assignments where the AI is irrelevant. It doesn't matter if you have access to it because I've asked you a question in such a way that it doesn't matter if you access AI or not. For example, if we were doing something live in class, a debate, and I wanted you to reflect on it, AI wasn't there to experience it. You're going to have your personal point of view. Or if I ask you to do an interview with somebody and then come into class and reflect on it, there's a strategy that was developed by Stanford and has been taken on by many called a flipped classroom. And the idea is, instead of the traditional, I give you information in the classroom and then you go home with homework and test and see if you know it, that model doesn't work too well because if you know it, then the homework's irrelevant. And if you don't know it, you can't do the homework and then you're bothering your parents. Now you've got AI that can do the homework for you. So that whole system is not working well. Instead, the flipped classroom has students really dig into the content at home. Do I personally care how a student learns? I don't care. If they didn't learn it from me and they've got a grandfather or grandmother or somebody who knows that, I don't care. If they get it from a book, a TikTok video, it doesn't matter to me. So if we have them do much of the learning at home and then under our supervision and assistance, apply it in class, that seems to make more sense. And if we do that sort of model where we don't really care about that piece of the AI, we care about how they demonstrate their understanding and how they personalize it and how they can show it and apply it to new things, then AI is less of a worry.
So really flipping the script of how we teach, how we approach education.
That's my hope.
Well, Juniper, earlier in this conversation, you brought up, I believe, the fact that AI has been around for a long time. It's not brand new. It's not something that just popped up in the last 2 years when ChatGPT became popular. Are there other moments or developments in history that come to mind where educators also had to have a similar moment like what we're having now, where we really flip the script on how we approach education, how we teach students in light of a new tool or technology?
Absolutely. I mean, I think we have these moments all the time when we have new technology. So when the computer came onto the scene, we really needed to figure out how to teach students how to use a computer, whether or not we wanted to integrate that into our classrooms. And I think there was also another really big moment where things like spell checkers came onto the scene. I think teachers were really worried that this was going to change the way students learned to spell, that they would not actually be able to spell correctly if we were automatically doing this for them. It doesn't seem like that has fundamentally changed people's ability to spell. So that was a good moment of history to maybe learn from. I think there have been so many of these moments throughout history, and it's really important for us to go back and sort of to learn that, you know, we can, if we use them deliberately, if we figure out good ways to integrate them into our teaching and learning, that we can make it through this.
Well, we just got an email from a listener named Paul. And if you have thoughts on this conversation, you can email us as well at vermontedition@vermontpublic.org or call 800-639-2211. Paul writes, AI, like the calculator, is a tool that can extend current existing human capabilities. But those capabilities have to exist in the first place. The results are only as meaningful as the thinking of the human that is employing the tool. The question Paul has, is why do U.S. students trail so far behind peer nations? Why does the wealthiest nation invest so little in its future citizens? So it seems like there's a concern there from Paul and perhaps others that the U.S., the education system here is already behind and might fall further behind with the increasing use of AI in classrooms. Kirk, is this something that UVM is concerned about?
Yeah, I'm thinking about the way it was put. I mean,
yeah,
as we said earlier, I think we have an unusual funding model compared to the rest of the world, and we have across the board averages that fail in comparison to countries that we would consider similar peers or even folks that are behind us in education. We also have one of the greatest education systems on the planet in terms of the impact that the knowledge economy has had on the US and on the world. And so whether we have a good one, a bad one, whether it's great, I mean, I think we have to be a little bit specific about where we're failing, and where we're failing is in, as Juniper pointed out, in educational equity across the board, particularly in the K-12 space. At the higher education level, we have, you know, universities across the board that have been world leaders. We also have a higher education space that's caused a lot of probably unnecessary student debt around some issues there since the 1990s. So it's really a mixed bag on all of those things. I think one of the things that we're really thinking about at UVM with AI is how this is likely to change how and where we interact with folks outside the university as well as inside. So we talked earlier about the sort of questions about regulatory things or opportunities we see in science, but also, you know, these are questions that come up in how prepared our students are when they come in. How do we have the kind of programs on the opportunity side that would draw students from across the country? I think it's more than just a tool and more than just a simple disruption at this point. I think it's really unsettling a lot of those things that we thought we knew pretty well.
Kirk, when we first talked, you mentioned to me some fascinating ways in which AI is disrupting one particular aspect of life at the University of Vermont, and that is the admissions process, both from the admissions staff perspective and from that of prospective students. Talk us through what's going on there. What are the changes that we might be seeing?
Sure. I think this came up, Michaela, when we were talking about, is this a threat or an opportunity? And of course, the answer is both. One of the things we want to think about in admissions, where writing is such an important part of the admissions process, is whether or not we're grading automated responses. These are very sophisticated language models that can write very convincing kinds of essays but deeply personalized, et cetera. So, I mean, we want to admit students more on the basis of more than just their ability to use a chatbot, obviously. And so these are important considerations. On the flip side, we process 30,000 applications for admission each year in our admissions office. And there are folks out there right now nationally, and I know Jay Jacobs, our head of enrollment management, is working on this, who are looking at how you could potentially use things like machine learning to lower the workload of that. Admissions is an incredibly extensive and costly process at a university. And so like many, many institutions, we look at how can you save money with this technology. We haven't implemented any of that yet, but I think that's on everyone's radar across higher education.
Mm. Mark, is this something that comes up in the trainings that you run, maybe preparing students to apply for college, but in a way that is ethical?
An interesting addition to that story is I had a teacher at a recent workshop say, well, first she began by talking about how a colleague of hers said, yes, I use AI to grade tests, and she had a real problem with that. So we had that discussion, and we thought, well, what if it could grade sort of the rote aspect of it, the multiple choices and the checking for grammar, so that you could spend more time giving them the constructive feedback on their writing or what was wrong with that sort of thing. And we thought, that's a good balance there. Likewise, somebody said, well, I just get so many requests from students to write college recommendation letters, I can't do it. But if I input the information, just drop what they give me and I put it into AI, it can at least give me a great first draft. So is that ethical? You know, this is why we're having this conversation, right? It's really for us to work out ourselves. And I think it's very important in having this conversation, because there are policymakers out there who, just as maybe sometimes we don't listen to students when we're making decisions in our classroom, policymakers need to listen to educators when they're making policies about education. And so these kind of discussions teachers should not only be having in their classrooms and in their buildings, but they should be taking it to, you know, the politicians who are looking to provide some quote-unquote guidance.
Yeah, yeah. Juniper, what are your thoughts there?
We really need to take a step back and really think about what we're asking for when we're looking at applications. What is the core information? And is this the right modality to be collecting that information is a good disruptive question, I think. Maybe there's other ways in which we could be gathering this information that might be less burdensome on the applicant and the reader. If both people are using generative AI to make this process easier, maybe we're not giving the sort of most streamlined process. So that might be a sort of an opportunity to look at a different type of application process.
Wow. The future in which both sides of this are just using AI doesn't seem like the most constructive thing. On that note, one thing I was thinking about when we were talking earlier about trust and teachers developing this trust with their students that will enable students to use AI in a way that feels ethical all around. Thinking about that next to the fact that teachers might be using AI as, you know, personalized tutors more and more often. How do you expect a student to develop trust when they're spending more and more time not with a human teacher but with a machine? Mark, does that worry you at all?
You know, some of these tutors and these chatbots that have been trained for certain purposes are very convincing. There are people, well, we've seen, you know, science fiction got to this first, right? It's been a couple hundred years since the first mention of artificial intelligence. But, you know, there have been movies where people fall in love with the AI because the responses are so convincing. So I don't necessarily see a student interacting with something that is close to a human response as being a negative thing, as long as I feel teachers need to set the example of being transparent. If we're using AI, we should show students how. Hey, I developed this rubric or this quiz, this lesson plan with the help of generative AI. Here's how. Let me now see how you want to use it and walk through. For both sides to work together in this learning process, I think is critical. I've done some workshops where I've had students side by side with teachers, for example, learning coding. It's huge because we are ultimately, as teachers, lifelong learners. And letting students know that we're not experts at this. We know that you as a student have grown up with this, and in some ways you're many ways better at this, but perhaps I, with my experience and knowing about the ethics and caring about certain things that you don't, together, if we go through this journey, this will be a much better output, an outcome.
Mm. Kirk, is there a way in which UVM is preparing its professors to handle these questions, training them on the uses of AI in the classroom? Is that a like department by department thing, or is that happening across the university?
So our Center for Teaching and Learning and our provost office are working to create a set of resources that can be university-wide that folks can draw on. Our libraries are working in some of that same space to develop information for students across the university. But, you know, and at the department level, it will be the teachers themselves, our professors, will also have the responsibility on their own of sort of figuring out how they want to do that. We, like any good university, we don't get in the business of telling our faculty what they have to do. That's a group decision, usually at the department level, to help set collective curriculum and so on. And so it's kind of a mixture, Michaela, of what you said. It'll be a mixture of university-wide resources and some guide rails, and then local implementation that really takes into account the expertise of our folks in the classroom. Mm.
Well, we have a teacher, in fact, calling in right now, Rebecca in Bethel. Rebecca, you're on the air. What's your question or your comment?
Well, I'm an art teacher, and I use Midjourney, which is a visual digital or AI program, and there's many of them. I use Midjourney because it has community standards, but I use that with my students to develop ideas and to give them kind of different perspectives on how to add something to their work. And I've used it even with youngest students because I teach elementary. And I wonder if people would talk about that a little bit as a different.
I think we just lost Rebecca, but Mark, I think we got the gist of her comment there. And I know, so Rebecca, you also got a little hand clap by Mark for being an art teacher and part of this conversation.
Yes.
Go ahead.
And using AI. I think the question was going to be about, what's the role of the elementary teachers, since obviously the first person hit with this would be, you know, college and secondary teachers who are assigning essays and they're being generated by ChatGPT. I've recently been asked to and have done workshops with elementary teachers. And what we, of course, I wasn't just a teacher. That was one third of my career. I was also a building principal at the elementary level and then a district assistant superintendent. So I've worked with many elementary teachers. And what I came to realize quickly after 12 years of being a high school teacher is all the foundational stuff happens before it gets to us. So we really need to focus on that. So even without being in front of a screen, teachers like the caller and others can be working with their students on the concept, the ethics of using technology, the idea of computational thinking. These might sound really complex, but in their essence, they're very fundamental ideas that kids can do. You can do machine learning with kids without even turning on a computer, the sort of idea that, oh, the more data I have, the easier I can make a prediction. That's machine learning. So I'm thrilled that we heard from an elementary teacher, and our summit is focusing on secondary because that sits right in the middle, and our future activities with AI Vermont are going to be at the elementary level and at the college level. Mm. Because it's really, really, we need to look at education as a continuum so that we're talking to each other, not they go here, I'm done with you, we move on to the middle of it. I'm done with you, we move on here. I've seen too much blame back and forth because there's not that communication. And I love that we had an art teacher come here because we also need to be talking outside of our content area silos because we have so much to learn from each other. And hearing somebody use Midjourney in art, I'll bet there's a social studies teacher out there who'd love to talk to you and say, how did you do that? Because I want the students to develop a map or, you know, some other graphic representation of my content.
Yeah. Well, exciting stuff ahead. Juniper, you're going to be part of this summit on Thursday. Tell us what you'll be talking about there in Burlington.
Yeah, I'll be talking about some of the ethical challenges with using AI in education, how you can benefit from using it, but how you might also come into some harm. And then I'll also be talking about this concept that Mark just brought up around computational thinking. How can we integrate that into our classroom so that we're while we're using AI in the classroom, students are also learning how these AI actually work and how to optimize their use.
And Kirk, as you look forward, you have, as you said, so many irons in the fire right now at UVM. What's one area in this world of artificial intelligence and generative AI that you're really excited to dive into, that you think very interesting work is being done right now at UVM? Kirk, do we still have you?
Sorry,
with us?
Wrong button. I got you there. sorry, unmuting by turning on my camera. So we, I think Juniper's colleagues in the Complex Systems Group over in our College of Engineering are doing, using their own large language models in doing sort of thematic and other kinds of analyses of large corpuses of texts. And so it's a sort of digital humanities phase two project. And it would be very difficult to read all of the existing laws of all of the nations of all time. It's not something a person could do. And yet you can ask a machine to do that and ask questions of it. And so I think in talking about building our own kinds of models around sort of dealing with the capacity of machines to deal with data at a level we've never seen before. I mean, that's just really exciting stuff, and it can give us a different kind of perspective. So that's a project I'm just super excited about. Mm.
And Mark, as you look ahead to this summit, is it sold out? I believe
it's
pretty full. For folks who aren't able to attend, but are educators in Vermont want to learn more about this subject, where can they learn more?
I'm so glad you said that because one of the main complaints of teachers about PD, including myself, is that it's one and done, right? You go to something and see you later. Good luck. Hope works out well for you. So the real geniuses behind AI Vermont are Chris Thompson and Denise Shakurjian, who are co-founders of Generator, the makerspace in downtown Burlington. And they're not fundamentally educators by profession, but they are mentally because they're curious, they explore, They use data and feedback to make decisions. And one of the great things that they've put in place is a website where, and I've never seen this anywhere before, we're going to be taking people's input and feedback on responses. If somebody tried something, they can send it to us. There'll be a platform, kind of a social media platform, where they can post something. Hey, I tried this with the AI. Other people can say, oh, why don't you try this? So there'll be a community that we're going to build online for between our summits so that we can both keep people connected and then use the feedback from that to drive our future ones. We don't have a roadmap laid out for how this is going to go. We really want to respond to teacher needs and student needs.
That's exciting stuff. I also want to add before we sign off today that I used ChatGPT yesterday a lot to prep for this show. I asked it a bunch of questions. I also used it to write a thank you note to my colleague Mitch Wortlieb for guest hosting for me last week while I was on PTO. It even included a little jab about the Red Sox and the Yankees for him. I did disclose to him that the thank you note was written by ChatGPT.
Awesome.
And we had a good laugh. But it's an exciting series of tools that we're talking about. Very thankful to all of our guests today for discussing them with us. Mark Natanagara is a teacher who runs trainings for educators on the use of AI. Mark, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
And Juniper Lovato, a researcher at the University of Vermont, thank you as well.
Always a pleasure.
And last but not least, Kirk Dombrowski, UVM's Vice President for Research. Kirk, thank you for your time today.
Of course, anytime.